Okay, we're starting here, seven lines from the bottom of Ayin Vav Amud Bet. Mar says, "I'm a Rav Papa. Hi, man, Zavin Leish Dora the Chavre. Someone who sells a document that documents outstanding credit. We'll call it a bond. Over here, he wants to sell it to his friend. Zarech leMichtav Lei. He has to write Kani Lachu V'Chol Shibuda Debate. He has to write or incorporate within the shtar that he's giving him to indicate the sale." That he sells him not only the object, the shtar itself, but all encumbrances that are connected to the shtar, which is the most important aspect of the shtar. The bond gives you the right of collection, but the most important part is the fact that you have that right of collection. The shtar itself is valueless, the underlying shtar. It's what's written in the shtar, the rights that are embedded in the shtar. That's what you're trying to pass on to the other individual. And that's done by saying that not only are you taking possession of it, but b'chosh shibuda debay, or everything that's internal to it. From here, the Rashbam suggests that his belief, or Rav Papa's belief, is that in order to sell a bond, you not only have to have a kinyan mesira, but you also have to have a shtar that backs it up. So Rav Papa is in essence saying that in order to sell a shtar, you need a kinyan plus a shtar to do that. Amar Rav Ashi, amrita l'shmaita kamei de Rav Kahana. I said this over to Rav Kahana. V'armit lei, you're suggesting here that if he wrote this language, it would work. He doesn't write this language, it doesn't work. Then why is he buying the shtar? Isn't it self-evident from the fact that he's buying the shtar and making a kinyan on the shtar that that's the purpose of the transaction? Because otherwise, what does he end up with? If he doesn't do what you're saying, and therefore the kinyan fails, the only thing he did is buy a piece of paper, because he's not getting the rights that are embedded in the paper, he's just getting the paper that the bond is written on. That means now that he bought a cork or a thing to stuff in the top of a bottle. It has no value aside from its paper value. So why would he go through all this trouble just to buy the paper and not to buy what's embedded, obviously what's written in the paper? So Amar Li, in. Letzur v'letzur. Says Eino Chanami. That's what he ends up with. That's all that he gets. So the way the Rashbam learns over here is that the Rav Papa suggesting that you must write a shtar to back up your kinyan, Rav Ashi comes to challenge that. He disagrees with Rav Papa and says, you don't need the shtar. You don't need the second shtar on top of the kinyan that you're doing. He says, otherwise, the failure to have a shtar, according to you, means that you have a kinyan that does nothing except buy you the paper upon which the bond is written. That doesn't make any sense. And Rav Kahana's response to him is, that's what happens. You don't do the proper protocol for buying a shtar. All you end up with is the paper, not the rights that are embedded in the shtar, but not the rights that are embedded in this bond. So that's the way that the Rashbam reads it, and he writes at the bottom, V'im ishum ona'ah. What about the fact that you have ona'ah over here? Yeter mishtut lahavi bitul mekach umachzir lo demav. V'zeh yachzir lo shtar chovo. Obviously, he didn't pay for paper over here. He was paying for the rights to collect the debt over here. So he paid far in excess of what the paper value was. So the Rashbam says, Eino Chanami, that there is a problem of ona'ah over here. And then you could nullify, you could reverse the transaction. Which is interesting only because we know that the dinim of ona'ah don't apply to karka and shtar. So over here, the reason that it will apply is because you didn't buy a shtar. You bought the paper. Had you bought a shtar, there wouldn't be any issue of ona'ah, but here, in the end, you didn't buy the shtar, you bought the paper. So buying paper, you could have ona'ah in it, because then you're trying to buy an object. You're buying something that has value, something that has inherent value to it, and you overpaid for it. So in that case, you can claim ona'ah, and you can reverse the transaction. So that's how the Rashbam reads it. The Balei Tosafot point out over here that he says, Omer Rashba, so the Rashi Mishan says, De'en la'vi raya, the savar apopo, de'en utiyot niknot b'misira. Because you can't prove from here that Rav Papa really believes that Ein Otiyot Niknot B'Misirah, which the Rashbam says. Rashbam says that Rav Papa's statement shows you that you do need to write a shtar on top of that. He says, how do you know? He says, all Rav Papa says is you need this language. He doesn't say you have to write this language. Maybe you just have to state this language. And so maybe according to Rabbi, who says that there's a Kinyan Misirah is enough, all you have to do is articulate the Kinyan Misirah in the following manner. Which is to say that it's kanilach hu v'chol shibud didei. That you just have to articulate that. Doesn't mean you have to write another shtar. Or you have to write a shtar, not a shtar as a shtar kinyan, But his shtar raya, that includes this language to show that that was the nature of the transaction. But not necessarily indicative of the fact that he's paskening that you need a shtar on top of the kinyan misira. The Rosh Mishnah disagrees with the Rashbam's conclusion that Rav Papa must believe, like the Chachamim, that you need a kinyan misira and a shtar. He says that's not what Rav Papa says. Papa just says you need this language. Could be that you have to write it according to the Chachamim. You have to articulate it according to Rabbi. But there is no proof from here that Rav Papa holds either way. So that has implications because, so according to the Rashbam, the Rabashi's question, Rav Papa, is a fundamental question. He's arguing fundamentally as to whether you need the shtar to back up the kinyan misira or not. Because there are other Rishonim where Rav Papa is not taking a position on that. He's just saying that this language is important. Then Ravashi is just questioning the necessity for this extra language. And why isn't that given, or why isn't that automatically subsumed in the transaction? Because it's obvious that the transaction is not here just to buy the paper. So why do you have to articulate it in particular just to have it be the default scenario? Because otherwise the transaction doesn't make so much sense that he's buying it for its paper value and not for that which is embedded in the paper. And then this would be subject to the machloket that we saw in yesterday's daf as to whether a kinyan misira can be used for metaltalim or for papers in this case. If you think a kinyan misira is the better type of kinyan or can function even in the place of mishichah or hagbah, then this would work. And then you have the question of the Rashbam, which is ona'ah. On the other hand, if you think that kinyan misira does not work in the face of hagbah and mishichah, then when he's saying here, latsur, latsur, means all I'm saying is the logic that you are dictating is wrong. That doesn't mean that the kinyan necessarily goes through or that there is a good kinyan over here. So then the conclusion would be multifaceted. First of all, do you think there's ona'ah over here? Is it, we'll see at the end of the day, sugya so big, or the differential so big that there is no ona'ah, or there's ona'ah and there's bitul mekach, or even if you consider it not to be ona'ah, maybe there's no kinyan at all because the kinyan misira failed. But whatever your conclusions are, all that Rav Kahana is doing is rejecting Rav Ashi's logic over here and saying that your logic doesn't stand.
The other thing the Balei Tosafot say here, which is subject to a major machloket, is Kanilach Iu v'choshi budei. He says, Avir mashma, t'mechir et shtar lo havi elamid derabanan. That you can only sell a shtar rabbinically. That this whole institution is a rabbinic institution, the ability to sell a bond. It's not a kinyan that works midoraita. The Chachamim instituted that you can do this, because anybody who can be mocher shtar, and you can be mochel on it, that shows you it's midrabanan. Not here. Later on in the Masechta, we're going to come across the fact, we've seen this actually before, that Shmuel has a shita, that anybody who sells a shtar or a bond, the original owner can be mochel on the bond, or mochel on the shtar. The fact that the original owner can be mochel on the shtar, Balei Tosafot see that as evidence of the fact that the shtar is never really sold. Because otherwise, why could he be mochel on the right to collect here? The fact that the original owner can still be mochel after he sold it to you is evidence of the fact that he never really sold it to you. So the institution is only a rabbinic institution that allows for this to happen. But midoraita, or underlying this, there isn't a real sale.
Although the Rabbeinu Tam argues that otiot niknot b'misirah, you can't sell a shtar midoraita. It's quoted in the Rosh that the Rabbeinu Tam believes that. And he answers this question of the Tosafot, how can you be mochel on the shibud if you're able to sell the shtar midoraita? So the Rabbeinu Tam, being the original brisker, makes a chakira or a chiluk in the types of shibudim that there are, and that's what the Rosh writes over here. T'ma'u taimed the mafresh Rabbeinu Tam, the mocher shtar chov sheyacholim chol, afapi shemidoraita amimecher. It works midoraita. Mishom deshnei shibudim yesh lo demal ve'alalove. The Malva has two encumbrances on the debtor. Echad shibud nechasav. One of them is an encumbrance of his possessions. Echad shibigufo. The other one is an encumbrance of his guf, meaning the person himself is responsible for the repayment of the loan. Mushubad lifrolo. Vishibud hanechasav shalove yochola malveh limkor. The shibud that the creditor has a right to sell is the encumbrance on the property. The encumbrance or the indebtedness of the individual's personal responsibility to repay the loan, that you cannot sell and that cannot be passed to the buyer. That's for that reason, when you buy the shtar, you have a right of collection, and you can go collect from the possessions of the loveh, because there's still an outstanding personal obligation to repay the loan. Aval imachala malved la loveh. If the creditor forgives the debtor's personal obligation to repay the loan, then paka nami shiba nichasav. Along with that, disappears the necessity to repay the loan from your possessions. The nichse dinish inun arevin bay. Because they are simply arevim, guarantors to the fact that he personally will repay the debt. So they are secondary line of repayment, which is that he personally guarantees the repayment of the loan, and then his possessions guarantee that his guarantee will be carried out. But that means if his guarantee to repay the loan personally is annulled, then so too is the necessity for his possessions to stand up and be the guarantee for that. And that's why the malve, the creditor, even after selling the right of collection, can go ahead and forgive the loan. And therefore, the Rabbeinu Tam disagrees with the view of the Baalei Tosfot here, and thinks that you can sell a shtar milve midoraita, right of collection, or a bond midoraita, through the mechanism that we saw here, votiot niknot b'misira, according to Rabbeinu Tam, that requires both a kidya misira, as well as a shtar. But if you do that, you've sold it to oraita, despite the fact, like the Gemara says later on, that the malvis still has a right to be mochel, still has a right to forgive the personal obligation of the loveh, which he could not sell in that transaction. Similarly, there is a machlok between the Rambam and the Raiva about this issue. That is a machloket amongst the Rishonim, as to whether, if you believe you can sell this shtar, does the shtar or the sale work? Only me, the Rabbanan, that's the view of the Baalei Tosafot, versus other Rishonim who believe that you could even sell it, me, the Oraita, that you have a Torah-ordained ability to create a kinyan and to move the item. Now, Amar HaMeimar, so now we have the conclusion of the sugya, which is Hilchoto Otiot Niknot B'Misira Karabi. So Meimar states the halacha. We have this in many cases in Shas, where the Gemara comes to a conclusion and brings down Hilchata, which is trying to indicate what's the final say on this. So the final say that you have here is Hilchata, that Otiyo Niknot B'Misira, that a Kinyan Misira by itself suffices, Kirabi, just like Rabbi, that's Machloket Rabbi in the Chachamim, and now you have a Psak Halacha like Rabbi. Amalei Rav Ashi La Meimar, Gemara Osvara. Is that something that you have B'Misora, or is that a logical argument? Amalei Gemara, that it is a Misora. Why does he need a Misora over here? Because we have a principle that when it comes to a Machloket Rabbi V'Chavero, Halacha K'Rabbi. When Rabbi argues on one other person, then Halacha is like Rabbi. When it's Rabbi and Chavei Rav, when it's Rabbi versus the Rabbim, then the Rabbim trump. Rabbi the Halacha is not like Rabbi. Over here you have Rabbi versus the Chachamim, and Rabbi versus the Chachamim should result in the halacha being like the Chachamim. So that's why he needs a Gemara. He needs a Misora to tell you otherwise. The truth is that maybe the Misora was the fact that we saw yesterday's daf, that who is the counterparty to Rabbi? Who's arguing on Rabbi is Rabbi Natan. That's what the Gemara said in the end, that Hane Tanae Ken Hane Tanae. That's where the Rashbam read it. That the two Machloket Tanaim, where you have Rabbi Natan versus the Chachamim and Rabbi versus the Chachamim, the Rabbonan in Rabbi's case was Rabbi Natan, and the Rabbanan in Rabbi Natan's case was really Rabbi. It was phrased as the Rabbanan, but it was the opinion of Rabbi versus Rabbi Natan. That's really one-on-one. That might be the Misora that he had, and that's what the Rishbam said yesterday. Rabbi v'Rabbi Natan, sof mishnah v'chaverim ayu. They were the end of the period of the Tanaim, of the Mishnayot. They were chaverim, and it would make sense that they were bal pluktot, that they were arguing here. So you could argue maybe that is the Misora that he had, that it was Rabbi Natan. That's why the loch is like Rabbi, but that's why you need it. So Amar Ravashi, Svarin Amiyu. He says it's also a logical argument. Ravashi, that's what the Rishbam said before, that Ravashi clearly agrees with the fact that it only needs a Kinyan Misira. You don't need a Kinyan that involves also a Shtar, that you need a Ktiva to go along with it. Because Ravashi says, I'll give you logic. Svaru Nami Dodiot Mile Ninu. The whole bond that you're trying to sell over here, the document that you're trying to sell over here, is simply words. Words can't be sold by other words. There is no advantage to writing a shtar to sell a shtar that exists already. If you have something that's intangible, then only a tangible action could actually sell it. To take another intangible to sell the intangible doesn't seem to do anything or doesn't add any value for you over here.
So if you hear devarim hu mocher velo maman mash, Rishbam says you're selling intangible items, you're selling words, you're not selling the object or the underlying object. Hilkach masebi adayim. You need physical, tangible way to transact with this. Hu ikar kniyatan. Shtar acher lo mahani. Another shtar is not going to help you. De mili mile lo miknu. Because when you have other milim, they're not mikne. The shtar lo, you can have a shtar. You can't have a shtar, acquire another shtar. Or in essence, what's the advantage of the other shtar over this shtar? If you can't sell this shtar, then why could another shtar do what you can't do with this shtar itself? So that's where the Rishbam learns. This is the Rishbam's Girsa and the Gemara, which is Amar Amemar Yochata Otiot Niknot Bemisira, that the conclusion of the Gemara is like Rabbi. It's also a Girsa that's backed up by the Tosafot Arid, and he brings the proofs that the Rishbam assumes and just says in a generic sense. He brings those proofs to show that the Rishbam's Girsa and the Girsa that's in our Gemara is correct. You can see that the Rabbeinu Gershom had a similar Girsa. The Rabbeinu Gershom says, Amar Amemar, Hilchata Otiot Niknot Bemisira. So now that's interesting because almost everybody disagrees with the Rishbam. It's strange to find that the Rabbeinu Gershom would agree with the Rishbam. But if you look carefully, the Rabbeinu Gershom has the same Girsa of the Rishbam, but a very different meaning to it. He says, Va'af agav dichtiv leik kanilach v'chol shibudei, lo kani b'lo misirat ashtar shel shibud. All he's saying over here, he's not saying what the Rishbam concludes. He's not saying the halacha is all you need is kinyan misira. He's saying, no. Otiot niknot v'misira means that the second shtar that you write to convey this to the other individual requires a kinyan misira. You need to give that to the other party in order for it to work. It's not enough that you just wrote the shtar. You have to actually hand it to him. So he actually adds on an additional requirement on top of the Chachamim. Chachamim said you need kinyan misira, shtar, and then we have a papa's qualification which says, yes, the koni lach v'kol shibuda debay. And then on top of that now, a Meimar is telling you have to give the shtar to the other party. So the Rebbeinu Gershom, he has the same girsa as the Rishbam. He clearly disagrees with the conclusion of the Rishbam. Rishbam's proof, he says, is the fact, says, v'chein rihita de gemara umaskana b'har be mekomot. The conclusion of the Gemara in many places in Shas is that otiot niknot b'misira. And if you go through Shas, you seem to find that he's right. That a lot of the Gemarot seem to lean heavily towards this position of Rabbi, that all you need is a kinyan misira and everything's done. On the other hand, you can see here in the Balei Tosafot, right up front say, Kotav Rav Yudai Gon, Dein otiot niknot b'chalipin. First of all, shtar cannot be acquired through chalipin. Can't use a representative kinyan to purchase something that is intangible. So that certainly wouldn't work. If you believe that you need a mesira, then kinyan chalipin is just not going to be the right vehicle for acquisition over here to acquire the shtar. But then he says, Ulrabeinu tam, ulri nira de garas, ein otiot niknot b'mesira kirabonon. The hachi hilchata. The exact opposite of the Rishbam. He says that a Meimer said, Ein otiot niknot b'misira. You cannot acquire through misira. Ela, you need to have a misira plus a shtar. Or in essence, they're pasking like the chachamim. Umayti raya. Now, why is this Tosafot so big over here? The reason the Tosafot is so big is because what the Rishbam said. The Rishbam said there are many other sugyot and shas that seem to support the view that the locha is like Rabbi and not like the chachamim. So this Tosafot, after he says the girsa is wrong, obviously, they had an earlier girsa. The Rishbam changed the girsa to match what he was saying. They're going back to the earlier girsot, because we know that the Rabbeinu Gershom has the girsa of the Rishbam. But if you look in the Rif, the Rambam, and all the others, the Gaonim, all have the opposite girsa, not the girsa of the Rishbam. They have a girsa that, Ein otiot niknot b'misira. And therefore, they all paskin like the Chachamim, and not like Rabbi. In the majority of Rishonim, don't have our girsa in the Gemara, and the majority of Rishonim paskin like the Chachamim, which would make sense. You have Machloket Chachamim and Rabbi, the Locha should be like the Chachamim. So now you have here a Tosafot who has to go now through all those cases in Shas that support the Rashbam. He's got to unwind them now. He's got to say why they're not right, or why it's not the case that it's saying Otiot Niknot B'Misira, but rather supportive of the conclusion of the Gemara over here. He brings some proofs to that fact as well, but he's also going to unwind some of the proofs that the Rishbam brings or thinks are in his favor. Then, when Ravashi says to Amemar, Gemara or Svara, is it a Gemara or Svara? Then when he says Gemara, that's the Mesora, what you have to say is that that's the Mesora.
His mesora is that halacha is like Rabbi mi chaveiro, but not Rabbi mi chaveirav. That was the mesora that he was implying over here. Because now he's paskening like the chachamim and not like Rabbi. That means that he's upholding that mesora. He's not going against that mesora. And therefore, that's what it means, gemara over here, that he's supporting that mesora. And then Rav Ashi amar svara namihu. It makes sense. Dotiot mile ninu. Umile bimile lo miknin. Oh, wait a minute. That was seems supportive of the Rashbam. He says, wait a minute, that's ishtar is mile, and a mile cannot be acquired through other mile, which means that you can't use another ishtar to acquire this ishtar. That's the way the Rashbam read it. So if you look down at the Balei Tosafot, obviously he's got a different reading of this Gemara. Vomiri, the mesirat ishtar karui mile. The handing over of the ishtar is what's called mile. Tekamrale kanilach ishtar zeh, dainu mile ba'alma. The whole way the mesira works is by saying, take possession of this ishtar, and then you take the ishtar. He sees exactly the opposite of the Rashbam. The Rashbam says you have intangible items here. A tangible kinyan, that's a real kinyan. Mile, writing another shtar, that's meaningless. He says just the opposite. He says that a mesira here is mile. That just says take possession of it. This is the Tosafot Shitato, who disagrees with the Rabbeinu Tam and the Rashi before, who say that when you do a Kinyan Mesira, you have to do it miyad miyad. You have to do it from hand to hand. Kinyan Mesira physically has to be passed from hand to hand. Balei Tosafot said that's not the case. Kinyan Mesira, the Rashbam, the Ri, all said that. A Kinyan Mesira can be, even without miyad miyad, you simply need the instruction of the giver. That's what the Rashbam said before also, that it's the mitzvah to mocher. As long as the mocher tells you to take possession of it, it works. So that's exactly what the Tosafot's describing over here. Lech chazek uknei, or over here, kanilach shtar zeh, take possession of the shtar. So he says, that's what mesira. Mesira involves mile. The way the mesira works is you're instructing him to take possession. That's how the mesira works. So he calls, that's the mile. And that's what the Gemara Vashi is saying. The mile fell over here. The mile fell over here because you tell him to go take a mesira. Mesira by itself is not enough. A shtar, that's a maisa godol. That's a real maisa to write a shtar. So that's Tosafot l'shitato. And that's why before, Tosafot was loath to accept the fact that Rapapa's statement was obviously paskening like the Chachamim. Maybe it's open to both of them. Because of Rav Ashi afterwards, Rav Ashi coming in questioning that position of Rapapa, Rav Ashi over here, according to the Balei Tosafot, thinks that like the halacha is like the Chachamim. So therefore, if you say that Rapapa's statement is generically applicable both to Rabbi and to the Chachamim, then you can argue that Rav Ashi's question might not only be on the position of the Chachamim supporting of Rabbi, but on both. He's saying, why does this language matter? Why is this, what is he going to do without the language? You're going to say it doesn't work? The answer is, yeah, it doesn't work without the language, but that doesn't prove to you whether Otiot Niknot B'Misira or not, because it's independent of that. Even Rabbi might require this language according to Rav Papa, and therefore Rav Ashi's statement is not a statement arguing about Rabbi and the Chachamim. Because over here, the conclusion is that Rav Ashi thinks like the Chachamim according to the Ri, according to the Balei Tosafot. So here you have two readings of the Gemara. They come to exactly opposite conclusions about whether you're able to sell a bond. Can you sell a bond simply by handing it to the other party and telling him to take possession of it? Or do you require another shtar to back it up? Then, on top of that, even if it works, say you did it with a shtar, according to those that require, like the Balei Tosafot, even with that, the Balei Tosafot think it's only efficacious at a rabbinic level. D'oraita, you can't sell the shtar. And so that's why you can be mochel afterwards, that you're able to be forgive the outstanding loan, even though you've already sold the loan to someone else. And it's only a rabbinic institution in order to facilitate people's ability to sell loans, sell receivables. Obviously, this has major implications today, because most of our transactions involve selling of outstanding debts, selling of receivables. In the marketplace today, that's a very big aspect of transactions, is taking what otherwise you have a right of collection or a right of outstanding credit and selling it to someone else. That's how you sell bonds. That's how you sell receivables. That's how you sell all of these things in the market. What do you need in order to do that? Is a Kinyan Mesira by itself enough? Or do you need a Kinyan Mesira with a shtar? Even if you do so, have you sold it only rabbinically or have you sold it even midoraita? So that's why there are major implications to this sugya, especially as you move away from tangible and bartering types of sales to sales of intangible items like this. This is a very important sugya that plays a heavy role in commerce today, in the way that you can transact in commerce today. Where it says, "Velo, is it really true
that you cannot sell milei b'milei. V'amar Rabba bar Yitzchak amar Rav, shnei shtarotim. There are two different types of shtarot. Zuchu b'step l'ploni, take possession of this field on behalf of someone else. V'katz v'lo et ha-shtar, and then write for him a shtar. Chuzer b'shtar, v'inu chuzer b'sadeh. He can retract the shtar, he cannot retract the giving of the field. In terms of the giving of the field, is zochin sh'adam shelo b'fanav. It's a zchut for the recipient of the field. When other parties take possession of it on his behalf, zochin shelo b'fanav, the transaction's over. The gifting or the granting of this field is done from the moment that the others took possession of the field on his behalf because they were zocheh on his behalf. On the other hand, a shtar or the writing of a shtar is to the detriment of the giver of the shtar. He doesn't want the shtar outstanding, and therefore it's to his detriment. Given that, the shtar is only effective once it reaches the final party. Just because these other parties now are going to write the shtar and do it on his behalf, the finalization of the shtar is only once it's given to the recipient. For that reason, the grantor over here can not retract with regards to the sadeh, but he can retract with regards to the shtar. The Rashbam and the Balei HaTosafot both ask over here, what's the problem with the shtar? Why can't you write a shtar? We're going to see it later on in the Masechta, that any time you have a transaction that involves edim, it's nitan likatev. That it is something, I'm sorry, not later on, we saw this back in Chazkat HaBatim, sorry. So that back, Adaf Mem, in Chazkat HaBatim, any time you do a transaction in front of two edim, nitan likatev. It's assumed that you're going to write a contract for it. It's as if there was a contract written for it, and you can write the contract without the permission of the mocher, because anybody who does a transaction in a public manner like that in front of Edim expects it to be documented, expects it to have a shtar. So why over here does he care whether there's a shtar? The transaction was done in front of Edim. Writing a shtar is part and parcel of that. So why over here don't we automatically say you get the shtar, and it's as if that is a given? So the Rashbam says, because the mistama nechale, the mikne, shichtavu shtar lekoneh. That is the default scenario. The default scenario is we assume, unless otherwise articulated, that he wants the shtar to be written to back up the sale. Here where he specifically articulates he does not want a shtar written, he has a right. He has a right of refusal to do that. So the Rabbeinu Tam solves the problem by limiting the case to a case of matana, because over there the shtar wouldn't be meaningful, and therefore he doesn't want the shtar written. But by mecher, where the shtar would have been written irrespective of his claim, or it doesn't make difference, all the halachic implications of a shtar already there because of the edim, in Ochanami, we would not listen to him and we would write a shtar. So Rabbeinu Tam says, this halacha that's part of our Gemara is limited to a case of matana. The other hand, the Balei HaTosafot say, what's the downside here in terms of the shtar? Because either way, the guy has achrayut, there is recourse over here, all these things apply. The shtar does nothing for him that he wouldn't have without the shtar. So why does he care that the shtar is written? So Tosfot says it's more of an intangible item, which is that the shtar will make it look like there are more outstanding debts that he has, or he sold property, or he has more transactions. People will be less likely to transact with him, lend him money, because they think he has outstanding debts, or he sold properties. Or if there's a gift, they might mistake the fact that he has a gift, they might mistake it as a debt or a sale of property. And given that, they might think that he is in financial strain or under duress, and then they won't want to lend to him. So Tosfot says it's a problem almost of marat ayin that this shtar will cause him, and therefore he has a right of refusal. The Ramban simply says that if a person doesn't want something, that's to his detriment. Doesn't matter whether there's any halakhic implication to it. If he doesn't want a shtar, and he says he doesn't want a shtar, that's something to his detriment. You can't do it without his permission. You can't do it without him granting you the right to do it. If he withdraws that right, then you can't write it, irrespective if it has any normative implications to writing the shtar. So you have three different reasons here as to why you can back out of the shtar. You have the Rishbam, who just says that the default is you give a shtar, but if he opposes it, not. Balei HaTosafot would say that it's just an intangible, there's risks he feels to having the shtar outstanding, and therefore he doesn't want it. Ramban says it doesn't matter what you think or what the reasons are. If he says he doesn't want it, that's enough to say that you can't do it without his permission. On the other hand, the other type of shtar is almanat shetichtivu lo et hashtar. If you say that grant him the land on condition that you write for him a shtar, chozer ben b'shtar ben b'sadeh. Because saying almanat means that that is a condition of the sale. condition of the sale is that you sell him the property on the condition that you write him a shtar to verify that. That means until the shtar is written, the property doesn't change hands, there's no kinyan. That means if he backs out of the shtar, then he's also backing out of the kinyan. He can stop the kinyan from happening because it was not finished at that moment. Even though generally we believe almanat means me'akshav, from now, because that's the Gemara says in Baba Kama, we learned that together, that once you use the Lashon of almanat, that's the equivalent of saying me'akshav, which would imply that the kinyan is immediate, even though there is a condition in here. What you have to say is that the fact that he says almanat yichtud v'lo shtar, that's an indicative of the fact that he doesn't want it akshav. He's almost in his language itself stating particularly that he's saying, I want the property, I want this whole transaction to be dependent on the shtar. And so therefore here you can't read the almanat as being me'akshav, but rather as a part and parcel of the way that you are gifting it. Not only are there two, there are three shtarot. Here we had two different types of shtarot. Here is a third one. Trei hadamran, the two that we just mentioned, which is the shtar that is after the gift. And then there's the shtar that is part and parcel of the gift. The third one is idach. What's that third one? Im kadam mocher v'katav et ha-shtar. If the mocher goes ahead and writes a shtar, ke'ota shishaninu, like we have learned before, kotvin shtar l'mocher, afal pi she'en lokeach imo. You're allowed to write, the sofer has a right to write the shtar for the mocher, even though the buyer is not present. So now, over here, in terms of a sofer writing a shtar, we don't want a sofer writing shtarot that are to the detriment of other parties, because the person who's coming to ask you to write it might be lying. There might have been no transaction. All of a sudden, the sofer draws up a contract. It's to the detriment of a party that's not present. He has to be aware of all the parties that are involved here. He has to make sure it's not lying and that it's really a shtar that should be written and should be signed on. He doesn't want to be a party to some sort of forgery. He doesn't want to be a party to a transaction that doesn't exist. For that reason, you're not allowed to write a shtar without the presence of the parties that are there. There are certain exceptions to that. One of the exceptions is a case of a mocher, a seller. That's what the Gemara is saying. So when you have someone who is selling a property, he's allowed to ask the sofer to write without the presence of the lokeach. The reason being is that the mocher is the party who would be hurt by the shtar. He's the only one whose detriment the shtar is for. So if you write the shtar for the person whose direct detriment is, what are you worried about? It's only bad for him, and he's already here telling you to write the shtar. That's why we would allow the mocher to do it. Now, the way that the Rashbam says, or the situation the Rashbam says is here is, Misha tzarich lema'ot. It's a case here where the mocher, the seller, is desperate for cash. He needs liquidity. The problem is, rotzelim kormin echasad chaviro, pamim shumotzeh sofer. Sometimes there's a sofer around, sometimes there's no sofer around. So he has preemptively, as the sofer, write the contract in order that he's ready to sell it whenever the sale comes. He wants to have an expedient sale. He wants the cash or liquidity immediately. The way to facilitate that is to have a shtar that's ready to go. And that's why he asks the sofer to write the shtar in advance of the transaction. The Rabbeinu Gershom says over here that the case is here. Im kadam v'katav lo et ha-shtar mechira, kodem shenatan lo ha-ma'ot, before he gave him the money. The Rishbam says that this is in advance because he's worried about the ability to find a sofer at the time. So he writes in advance. So what about the fact that it's mechse kashikra? What about the fact that it looks like you are lying? So he says here, at the top of the next amud, he asks your question, he says, mutal asot kein, avgav de mechse kashikra, de'en kanefse, de shum adam, elo lemocher atzmo. Even though it looks like the transaction's already happened, and it's mechse kashikra, we don't worry about that because the only loser here is the mocher. And the mocher is the one telling you to write it. The mocher is going to be in the possession of this contract. If he loses it or anything happens to him, it's his problem. He owns the problem, lock, stock, and barrel. And therefore you can write it for him in order to facilitate whatever he wants. That's the way the Rishbam reads it. The Rabbeinu Gershom, on the other hand, sees it as being more problematic. He says here, mekotam mekotam lo teshtar mechira, kodem shenatan lo ma'ot, before he gave the money. So over here, the Rabbeinu Gershom thinks that he knows the counterparty already. He knows who the counterparty is. He's writing the shtar in advance of the money changing hands. But again, it evidences the fact that the transaction was complete, which means the money already changed hands. You're still allowed to write it for him. So the Rabbeinu Gershom sees this as later in the process of the sale. Rashbam seems like he's writing it generically, without knowing who the buyer is. Whereas the Rabbeinu Gershom seems to indicate he knows the buyer already, just hasn't completed the transaction. He's writing in advance of that transaction. Now, kotfin shtar lemocher, afal pishein lokeach imo. That's what we learned, that you're allowed to write a shtar from mocher even though lokeach's not there. Kevin sheikzik ze bekarka, nikne shtar b'chol makom shu. So this is the third shtar that we have. This is a shtar that comes as a kinyan agav. That once the buyer here now takes possession of the property, not only does he get possession of the property, he gets possession of the shtar along with the property. Zohu shishaninu. This is what we learned in the Mishnah in Kiddushin. Nechasim she'en lehem achrayut. Property that has no recourse, or in essence, mitaltalin. Niknim nechasim she'esh lehem achrayut. Are acquired along with other property that is real property that require a kinyan of kesef, shtar, and chazakah. The way that you acquire real property is one of these three mechanisms for a kinyan. Kesef, through money, shtar, or chazakah. All of those are vehicles for acquiring real property. When you acquire the real property, even though those are not mechanisms for acquiring the unreal property, you have a kinyan agav. You can throw in, or you can have other items that are contained in the sale that are non-real property. That the Gemara in Kiddushin learns from Sukkim, that there is such a thing as a kinyan agav. So now, this is all to get to the Gemara's question. We just got to the Gemara's question, but first of all, we have to understand what happened here. We had two shtarot that we said before that can evidence a sale, and what the meaning of those shtarot are. The first one was a shtar that was after the gift. There he can withhold the shtar, he can't withhold the gift. The gift is done, or the giving was done already. That's number one. Second shtar is a shtar that is a condition of the sale. That the sale or the gift doesn't go through until the shtar is complete. In that case, he can reverse the sale until the shtar is given, because that is a condition of the sale. Our third shtar here is a shtar that's written in advance of the transaction. Then at the moment of the transaction, the shtar goes into the possession of the other party. So the transaction completes the sale of the actual object, but not only does he get the object itself, he gets the shtar along with the object as a kinyan agav. That is the third shtar. Now, the question of the Gemara was, is it really true that mile b'mile lo niknin? That words cannot be acquired with other words? That's the Gemara's question. But that's not true. Look at this case. The case here is this third shtar. This third shtar was niknei ayidei mile. How that happened? Very good question. Over here, the way that the Rishbam says it is, v'afu pi shlo ba shtar liyado, even though he never gets physical possession of the shtar, the lokeach konilei, the lokeach still gets possession of it. Koshkein le'el shtar b'shtar miknei. In essence, what the Rishbam is saying is that a kinyan agav is mile. A kinyan agav works because you say that included in this sale is not only the land itself, but also some other objects. You can pick anything you want. You can sell any other metaltalin along with the karka. So if you have the karka that goes through in the sale, the metaltalin get taken along with this karka. So too the shtar. This shtar, which is mile, is able to be acquired with the land. Did you ever pick up the shtar? Did you ever make a kinyan on the shtar? No. You're only getting it because he said it was included in this transaction. There's this shtar outstanding. That shtar, which was only done through instruction, the ilohacha afilu b'mile gride kanile below shtar. Just like over here, the shtar can be acquired even though there was no physical kinyan, then certainly the shtar in our case can be acquired through mile, can be acquired by simply stating something. And that's because Mistama, he wrote the shtar to benefit the buyer and he wants it to go along with the sale. So just that intent, or that writing of the shtar that we assume is in favor of the party, goes with the kinyan agav. So those are the mile. Just through mile, this kinyan agav is successful at acquiring the shtar on behalf of the buyer. According to Rishbam, why is Rav Ashi being a proof to the fact that you need a kinyan mesira and mile, and a shtar will not work to acquire another shtar? Over here you see that you do have the ability to acquire through mile a shtar. You simply add a kinyan agav. That's the way the Rishbam learns it. And the Balei Tosafot, continuing their position from before, believe that Rav Ashi, when he says mile b'mile, he's talking about the kinyan mesira. He's saying that the kinyan mesira is something that cannot acquire by itself, because that's just mile, that's just an instruction. So the instruction's not enough. To do it, you need a shtar to back it up. So now the Balei Tosafot say, then what's the proof from here? So they say that the proof is the following, that the Gemara is assuming that a kinyan agav is a substandard type of kinyan. You have a kinyan meshicha, you have a kinyan agba, kinyan mesira. Those are real kinyanim. Kinyan agav, that's a substandard type of kinyan. What do you see here? That even a substandard type of kinyan works to acquire a shtar. It works to acquire other things. So just like a substandard kinyan works to acquire a shtar over here, so too the kinyan mesira, which vis-a-vis the shtar is a substandard type of kinyan, that should work by itself because we see substandard kinyanim work in these cases to acquire shtarot. So just like a kinyan agav works, so too a kinyan mesira should work over there to work without ktiva, without another shtar to do it, it should work.
Nobody says this, but I thought the possibility is that you can acquire the karka through shtar. And that means that the acquisition of the kinyan agav is done through a shtar, and therefore you could have a shtar that's acquiring a shtar. And that's the question of the Gemara, that you have milei that are acquiring milei now, because the shtar acquires the karka, which acquires the other shtar. And that means through a shtar, you're acquiring another shtar. Though I didn't see that interpretation in the Rishonim.
The Gemara answers, agav shiny. Agav is a different type of kinyan. What is that? Damat beya delo nikne bichalipin. Begavara nikne. This goes back to our days in Boba Metzia, where we talk about in the Perek HaZahav that one is unable to acquire coins, currency, with a kinyan chalipin. Remember, that's the first Mishnah in HaZahav, that there is no kinyan chalipin with currency. Why is there no kinyan chalipin in currency? The Rishonim, if you remember over there, it said one of two reasons, one of which is that you're not trying to buy with the kinyan chalipin and money. Money is not bought for its underlying value, but rather for the tzura that's on the coin. The value of the coin is not just the underlying metal, but it's the way that it's forged or minted that makes the difference. So now you can't acquire through a kinyan chalipin something that doesn't have underlying value, where it's an intangible that you're trying to acquire. For that same reason, many believe that a kinyan chalipin doesn't work to acquire debt documents. That's what we saw in the Tosfot before, that Rabbi Yehudai Gaon says, "Ein otiot niknot be chalipin." That you cannot acquire through a chalipin. The other view is that money is a currency and not an object. Since it's a currency that's used to buy other things, you can't buy it through a representative kinyan. It just doesn't work. Representative kinyan works when you're trying to buy objects, trying to buy metaltalin. When you try to buy currency, currency itself is a mechanism for stored value. It's a mechanism for acquisition. So you can't acquire an acquisition vehicle through a kinyan chalipin. That'd be doing like the same thing twice. Using a representative item to buy a representative item. That doesn't work. Coinage in itself is representative of value, and so therefore you can't use a chalipin to acquire it. But, despite the fact that a kinyan chalipin does not work to acquire coinage or currency, a kinyan agav does work. That means if you have money on land, you can acquire that land and the money will come along with it as a kinyan agav. So what you see from this, according to the Balei Tosafot, that kinyan agav is a strong form of kinyan. It's on level, on par with other kinyanim, like a kinyan meshicha and a kinyan agba, because it is better than a kinyan chalipin. It's not just a representative kinyan. It's not just this kind of wishy-washy kinyan. It's a full-fledged kinyan. So therefore, you can't prove anything from here, because you're talking about a full-fledged kinyan. You can't prove anything about a kinyan mesira from here. That's the way the Balei Tosafot learn. On the other hand, the way that the Rashbam learns is, V'lav hainu mile elam maisa godohu. He says the way the Rashbam learns it is that what was his problem with this was that a kinyan agav was just mile. You say, along with this is going to come this other item. So that means that you're using mile to include the metaltalim in the kinyan karka. The answer is no, kinyan agav doesn't work like that, because if it was just mile, you wouldn't be able to acquire currency and coinage. What the acquisition of currency through a kinyan agav shows you is that this is a full-fledged kinyan. We look at it as if you took possession of these metaltalin. Not that he told you, the kinyan karka, now you get the coinage. No, that means that when you have a kinyan karka, we look at it as if you took possession physically of the coinage of the currency, and it's like a kinyan meshicha. Therefore, it's a full-fledged kinyan, and you can't prove anything from here. According to the Rashbam, according to the Tosafot, each one the shitoto, kinyan agav is a full-fledged maaseh, and therefore, it can't prove anything to our case over here.
And the answer, according to what I said before, or the suggestion that I made before, would have to be that kinyan agav shiny means that the kinyan agav works in two stages. There's the shtar that acquires the karka, and then the karka that acquires the agav, the other shtar. So it's not that it's a shtar acquiring a shtar, but rather there's some interface in between. And that's why the shtar can acquire the other shtars, because of the karka that's in between. And the karka functions to be a full-fledged kinyan on the agav, the other shtar, and it's not directly the shtar to shtar that creates the kinyan. In the end, how successful a kinyan agav is in acquiring a shtar, is for instance over here, where the guy's trying to sell a debt document. If he uses a kinyan agav rather than a kinyan mesira and ktiva, depending on who you hold like, does this replace all of that? So there are those like the Rif and the Rambam that believe that a kinyan agav gets you the mesira and the ktiva. It's full-fledged kinyan. There are other Rishonim who work the kinyan agav replaces the mesira, but you still need a ktiva. Or others like the Rosh suggest that the kinyan agav is successful at replacing the mesira. You don't need a ktiva, but you do need the articulation of a papa from before, which is that you have to say that you're giving him the shtar, the choshi budav, that's included in this kinyan agav, in order for it to be successful. Ki'adar papa, similar to the case of a papa, avalei tracer alfei zuzei bechozai. He had 12,000 zuz, a significant sum of money, that was kept by bechozai. According to our gemara over here, the girsa that we have over here, Rav Papa had deposited the money over there, and he wanted to get his money back after it was deposited. The Gemara in Baba Kama that we learned together, the Girsa over there, was different. The Girsa in Baba Kama is, Ki'adar Rav Papa, have a mesik le trefer asay zuzei bechozai. He was a creditor to these individuals in bechozai. He had lent them 12,000 zuz, which was a significant sum of money that he had lent them. The difference in Girsa has huge halachic implications. So I'm going to read you the Gemara as we have it here, which was that it was a deposit and not a loan outstanding. So he deposited the money over there, and he wanted the money back. So he sent Rav Shmuel Bar Acha, Akniu Niyalei to Rav Shmuel Bar Acha. He gave over to the possession of Rav Shmuel Bar Acha, Agava Seifed Debeite, through the threshold of his house. He gave him an acquisition of that money over there. Rabbeinu Gershom says, a seif in the beite doesn't mean the threshold of his house, but rather sof beito. Agav chatzero shu sof beito. He did his kinyan agav with his chatzer, the back of the house, or the sof of the house. He just translates the word seife differently. Ki ata, when Rav Shmuel Bar Acha came back, nofak de'abe ad tabach. He went out to meet him until tabach. Tabach seems to be a city or location somewhere between where Rav Papa was located and bechozai. So he went out to greet him. Why he went out to greet him also has implications here in the story. So let's just take a step back. What he did was a kinyan agav, in essence. He gave Rav Shmuel Bar Acha possession of the money that was his by the people who were holding it on his behalf. So he had it, he gave it to him. He says, take possession of my threshold of my house. Together with that, I'm giving you possession of the money. You are now the owner of the money. The reason he had to do that is because the parties in Bechozai would refuse to give it to Rav Shmuel Bar Acha unless he was the owner of the money. Without a harsha, without basically a power of attorney, they would not give it to him because they would be responsible for the money until it was returned to Rav Papa. They are responsible for anything that happens to the money on the way back. They don't want that risk. They don't want to assume that risk. So the only way they're going to give it to another party is if that party is fully responsible, or in the essence, they've given the money back to the owner. So that's what Rav Papa did. He gave the ownership of the money to Rav Shmuel Bar Acha. Now, Rav Papa is going out to greet him, can represent a number of items. One possibility is that going out to greet him can represent the fact that he believed that he would come back with the money, that he would get the money. But that also indicates that he thought his kinyan was efficacious, and therefore he went out to greet him because he was certain that he would get the money back based on what they had done. You could say that he went out to greet him because he was just excited to get his money back, that he wasn't sure, he was uncertain about getting his money back. Or you could say he went out to greet him because he wanted to make sure he got the money from him before Rav Shmuel Bar Acha realized that he was really the owner of the money. I mean, now he gave him the power to be the owner of the money in order to collect it. That means that Rav Shmuel Bar Acha could walk away with the money. So Rav Papa went out there to make sure that he got the money back before Rav Shmuel Acha got smart and said, I can take the money by myself. All right, so now that's the way to read it based on our Gemara. That was a pikadon. The Baalei Tosafot raised the issue with regards to the Girsa in Baba Kama, and that is Mesik Bezuze. That if you have an outstanding credit and it was a loan, and then he gave him the acquisition of the loan, that presents us with a problem that the Baalei Tosafot raised over here, which is in the case where it's a pikadon, that means that the money belongs to Rav Papa, and then he can do a kinyan agav to grant him the rights to the money, and that's how he owns it, and he can take it back.
When you have a credit outstanding, you lent money to these individuals, there's nothing tangible to do a kinyan agav with anymore. What are you doing a kinyan agav for? You're doing a kinyan agav for the right of collection? There's no such kinyan agav that's going to work. Kinyan agav works when you have karka, real property, can acquire non-real property along with it. It can acquire other things along with it that require a kinyan. But over here, you have an intangible item, which is the right of collection. There's no tangible item left when you lend money. Money that's given out is latsanit. No, it's given to be spent. You don't expect the person to give you back the exact same coins you gave them. You expect them to pay back the value that you lent them. Therefore, there's nothing tangible to acquire over here. And that's what's bothering the Balei Tosafot, which is that you can't acquire a loan or you can't give it over. If you have the Girsa of Masik Bay, that proves that you could give over a loan. That goes against what we know in other places in the Gemara, especially later on Kuf Nun Bet in Baba Batra. Seems to indicate only a Shechiv Meirah could do such a thing, give over rights of collection. But a Bari, a healthy person, doesn't have a right to give over that Kinyan to someone else. And so by a Milva, the only way to get that transfer, that ownership, is through Mamad Shloshtan or a Harsha'ah. But you can't do it through a Kinyan Agav because there's nothing to be Kone over here. And that's why the Rishonim favor the Girsa that we have in our Gemara. And the Rabbeinu Tam says over here, even though you can't create a kinyan because of what we just suggested before, nevertheless, a harsha'ah works over here. That's a takanat chachamim, that a harsha'ah, that a power of attorney will work in this case, despite the fact that an underlying kinyan would not work. And similarly, mamad shloshtan, there, it definitely works because then you have the debtor involved in the transference of the shibud. And so for there, for sure, you can create that transference of ownership. But a plain kinyan, like a kinyan agav, would not work by a debt. For that reason, they favor heavily the girsa that we have here, and think the girsa in Baba Kama is incorrect. But according to those that do have the girsa of Masik, what you have to say is what the Rabbeinu Tam says at the bottom of the Tosafot. V'on Rabbeinu Tam, takanat ha-chamim hi, l'inyan harsha'ah. Chamim instituted a takana that you can create a harsha'ah, basically a power of attorney, yuchal la'asot shliach, afilu b'ashat milveh, afagav den yochol la'aknotah. Even though you do not have the ability to grant ownership of a loan to someone else or the right of collection to someone else, nevertheless, they allow through a power of attorney to get this someone the right of collection to go get it on your behalf. And the kinyan, like the Rabbeinu Tam says over here, is a mechanism for harsha'ah. It was to create the harsha'ah, to create the power of attorney to make him into a shliach that was effective. And that's what the kinyan was over here. It wasn't a kinyan to give him possession of the item, but rather it was a kinyan to give him the right of harsha'ah, the right of collection, in order to act as a power of attorney or in place of the owner himself. And that, the Rabbeinu Tam already told us, is a din d'rabbanan to create liquidity in the shuk. Many of these takanot are takanot to help the liquidity and the functioning of the shuk, of the marketplace as a whole. If you're not going to allow people to collect on behalf of others, it's going to make people less willing to lend out. That means that they physically have to go and collect the money. They're not going to want that. They're going to have the ability to send parties that are going to collect on their behalf. And so therefore, they're going to want this ability. They do it through a harsha'ah. Otherwise, you need other types of transactions, which is called mamad shloshtan. You need all three of the parties there in order for this to be a transaction, to give you the right of collection or to pass the credit to another party. You need mamad shloshtan, which is obviously not possible here, because he's sending him to Beit Chozai, to the people who were the debtors. So you could not have mamad shloshtam in order to do that. So that's what the Rabbeinu Tam in the end says, is that you can get over the problem. It's a technicality that you're right. You can't do this. But the Chachamim instituted a way to do this, even though it shouldn't work through normal mechanisms of kinyanim. All right, so now the Gemara continues back to the Mishnah about lo machar lo et lo et avadim lo et marzufim lo et antike. So it goes back to the Mishnah. We got lost on the way here. We got into a whole bunch of agadata. And then we got onto this sidebar about otiot niknot mimisira or not. Now we're back to our Mishnah, which is the Mishnah enumerates certain things that are sold with the Sfina and certain things that are not sold with the Sfina. The things that were left out were the Avadim, the Marzufim were the sacks, and the Antike. The Gemara wants to go, my Antike. What is this Antike that are not sold? Amra Papa Iska de Gabava. It is the merchandise or the tradables that are in the boat. That's the way the Rashbam translates it, prakmachia shiba. The load or whatever it's carrying in the boat, the merchandise that's there, that's not included in the sale. On the other hand, you look in the Masorta Shas, you can see over here there's a little dehe that goes up over there. The hay says, perish, hua mamon shibitoch hasfina.
That's the money that is in the boat. Or the other alternative view here is that the antique are not the merchandise, but rather the money. Say, for instance, he took merchandise, he's on his way back with the cash that's in the boat. So that has huge implications, because as I said on the Mishnah, if there's cash on the boat, it wouldn't be sold with it, because it's not one of these items, because it's not iska, it's not shayach to the boat. According to this shita, it is shayach to the boat. The reason that you might say that is because the marzufim, the sacks, are not sold with the boat. If you already tell me that the sacks are not sold with the boat, then it seems obvious that the merchandise is not sold with the boat, because if the sacks don't go, then what are you selling the merchandise? The sacks that hold the merchandise don't go with the boat, which are more likely to be connected to the boat, because they're the thing that keep the items in the boat, then certainly the merchandise shouldn't go. So you have to come up with something else that's not included in the Mishnah, and that might be the version that thinks that antike means money, cash. On the other hand, the Rishbam and others say that merchandise might be independent of the sacks. The sacks are the way to hold the merchandise, but sometimes the merchandise is not in the sacks. And therefore, you could have a case where the merchandise is in the boat, or the Ikar is to tell you the other way around. That when you sell the boat, when you say it's the Sfina and everything that's in it, you say, okay, the sacks go because they're part of the working part of the boat. But the merchandise, that's totally independent. That's the Ikar part of the Mishnah teaching. Not only does the sacks or the storage utensils go with it, so does the merchandise when you say the boat and everything that's in it. So that might be the Chiddush according to that Shita. But that's the way the Rishbam reads it, that it's Iska, and most Rishonim read it that way. There is an alternative. You can see here in the Masorta Shas, who brings down that the Oruch says that it was money and not merchandise. Okay, next Mishnah. Next Mishnah continues thematically what we've been doing until now, is that we sell an item, what's included, what's not included. Macharet a karon, lo macharet a pradot. You sell the wagon, you don't sell the mules that pull the wagon. That's what the Rabbeinu Gershom says over here. Lo macharet a pradot, shemoshchim et a karon, mishum dolo shaychi de karon. Derech pradot nimshoch kronot. The derech shvarim lachrosh. It's a normal way for mules to pull the wagons. It's normal for oxen to pull the plows. The derech chamor, and it's a normal way to have a donkey, lemasui, is for carrying loads on itself. The derech sus, lechiva, and a horse is used for riding. So why does it mention pradot in the Mishnah? Because they were the normal thing hitched up to a wagon. That is the view of the Rabbeinu Gershom and the other Rishonim over here, who basically say that the case here is that you have the wagon and the, we'll call it the motor that moves the wagon, which are the mules over here. When you say I'm selling you the wagon, I'm not selling you necessarily the mules or the motor that goes along with it. Macharet ha-pradot, if you sell the mules, lo macharet ha-garon, you didn't sell the wagon with it. They're seen to be independent items, completely independent to the case that you can sell one without the other. Even though they're normally associated with each other, they're not necessarily one and the same. And because of that, you have to separate between them. We're going to see in a second in the Gemara that this is the case, but the Rashbam mentions it here, that this is when they're not hitched together. It's not when they're not attached. They're not attached right now. Therefore, when you sell the wagon, you don't automatically sell a pair of mules to go with it. You sell a pair of mules, you don't get the wagon with it. But if they're hitched together, then when you sell one, the other one comes with it because they're now considered to be a unit or a singular unit together. It's equivalent of buying a tractor trailer. You can buy the trailer because you can bring another tractor. They're interchangeable. So it's the same thing here. Mules are interchangeable. The Rambam in Perashat Mishnayot has a different view about what the pradot over here. He says they're not mules, but rather they are the arms that are the hitch to put the animals on. And you have the wagon, and then you have two pieces of wood or poles that come out of the wagon that you would attach the animals to. And what he's saying over here is that macharet ha-karon, lo macharet ha-pradot, means that you don't sell, and you would say parrot or pradot over here means a pair. The pair of poles or the items that hitch the wagon to the animals. So that would be the way the Rambam learns it, and then you have to explain in the Gemara. We'll explain in a second how that fits into the language of the Gemara. Machar et semed, lo machar et bakar. If you sold the yoke, you don't sell the bakar, the oxen. That's what the Rabbeinu Gershom just told us, that oxen go together with the yoke to pull the plow. So that, if you sell the yoke, you didn't sell the animals, the oxen. Machar et bakar, you sold the oxen, lo machar et semed, you didn't sell the yoke with them. Even though generally the two are associated with each other, nevertheless they're considered to be independent items. Reyudo Omer, hadamim modin. Just check the price. The price will tell you what he bought. Obviously, if he paid more than the value of a yoke, he's paying for the yoke and the animals. He paid for more than the value of the animals, he's paying for the animals and the yoke. You could tell from the price what's going on. Mishnah says, Ketzad, how do you know? Amar lo macholi tzimadcha b'matayim zuz. Sell me your yoke for 200 zuz. Hadvar yadua shenat semed b'matayim zuz. Nobody buys a yoke for 200 zuz. And obviously, then he wants the bakar with the yoke. There's nobody's buying a yoke for that much. The price is never evidence of what happened in this sale. We'll have to see what that means, that it's not evidence of the sale. But what we're going to suggest now is that he just gave it as a gift. He gave the remainder of the money as a gift. For you, my good friend, I'll pay you a little more for your yoke. So now, Tani Ravakta Chalifa Bar Marav Kamed Rabbi Bo. Machar, he brought a braita that says, Machar ta karon, machar ta pradot. You sell the karon, the pradot, go with it. Vanan lo machar tznan. Wait a minute, doesn't our Mishnah say just the opposite? So Amalei, isme, should I throw this braita out? Is it an invalid braita? Amalei, lo, titarge matniteich badukim bo. Explain braita in a case where they're hitched together, and the Mishnah where they are unhitched. So that's what we said before. The Rishbam noted that in the Mishnah, but that's based on this Gemara here. That the Mishnah, where you say that the wagon and the animals are not a singular entity, is when they're not hitched together. They're hitched together and he buys it, he's assuming they come as a package, and therefore he buys both of them together, and that's what the Braita is speaking about. For the Rambam, what you have to say is that these two poles, or these pieces of wood that you put on, are not permanently there, they're outside the wagon. They're things that are attached to it, in order to facilitate hooking up to the other item. Today, that would be the equivalent of a hitch that is put on a car. That's an extra. You don't buy the car and automatically get a hitch. You have to put the hitch on. Now, once the hitch is on, maybe that has implications that the hitch comes with the car. You don't assume he's going to take that welded hitch off of it. So that'd be the way that the Rambam explains it over here versus the Rishbam and many of the Rishonim that's talking about mules and the wagon as to whether they're attached or detached. The Rishbam over here says this only applies to the first case in the Mishnah, not to the second case in the Mishnah. By the yoke and the oxen, it does not matter whether they're attached or not attached. One does not sell the other. They are considered independent, irrespective of whether they have the yoke on or don't have the yoke on. Others disagree with the Rishbam and say that just like in the first case in the Mishnah, it's only when they're detached. So okay, too, in the second case in the Mishnah, it's only when they are detached. Right now the Gemara says, Machar tzemed or machar tabakar. Hey chidami, what is the situation over here? What's the case? Ilema tokaru litzimda tzimda lo bakar bakar. If you call a yoke a yoke, and you call oxen oxen, then pshita tzimda zavinle bakar lo zavinle. He said, I'm selling you a tzemed. Tzemed means a tzemed. It does not mean a bakar. If that's the case, then you know what the answer is. The answer is he only sold him a yoke. He did not sell him the bakar, and we're done. Vela decorrelay nami the bakar tzimdo. If people call, when they say a yoke, it means not only a yoke, but also means the oxen that go along with the yoke. Kule zaminle. It's done before you started. He said, I sold you a yoke. The word yoke includes oxen. Then there's no question here. He sold him the oxen as well. So what's the case in our Mishnah where there's some sort of uncertainty here about what should be sold? Lo tzricha ba'asher decorrelay tzimda tzimda or the bakar bakar. In a city where people call yoke a yoke, and they call oxen oxen, the ikanami, the car, the bakar, tzimda. But there are people in the city also who call the word semed, use the word semed to include oxen as well. So here we are uncertain as to which one of these people he is from the city. When he said the word semed, did he mean semed and semed alone? Or is he of those other type of people who say semed means semed and bakar? So over here we say, Motzimi chavero lavaraya. Based on that, the mocher has the upper hand, and the lokeach is the one who's out of luck. He gave his money already, and now we're trying to decide what he gets. He's on the yado al tachtona. Motzimi chavero lavaraya. The mocher says, I only sold you a yoke. I didn't sell you the bakar. The lokeach says, what do you mean? You sold me the bakar as well. Says, prove it. I'm of those people in the city that thinks that semed means semed and not semed and bakar. So that is leaves the lokeach in the losing position over here. That's the way they explain it. Just to note that we had this similar Gemara earlier in the Masechta, and over there the Girsa and the Gemara, it's not exactly this case, but very similar cases with Machareta Bait. And the Gemara asks the same question over there, what was meant. The Gemara in the end concluded the following, which is, Ba'acha deruba, the majority of karlet simtet simba le bakar bakar, ve'ika miuta. There is a miuta that karlet le bakar et simda. That there is a miut that calls it that way. So the Gemara before says, even if it is a miut that says it that way, that would also be the case. To match it up with the girsa back on Samach Aleph Amud Bet, by the case of Mocher Bayit Chaveiro Bibira Gdola, as to what's included in that sale of the Bayit and the Bira Gdola. So there the Gemara has the same type of language, and this is the way the Gemara concludes, and therefore to match the language here to there, some Rishonim have the same girsa over here, which is that it's a rov and a miut, not where it says over here, that seems to be equal cases. Gemara says, V'rabbanan Savre, in a Dami Raya. Rabbanim believe that money is no indication. V'ena Dami Raya, lavi bitul mekach. Wait a minute. If the money is no evidence, you have a problem of ona'ah here. He's overcharging for the item. He's overcharging the item. The transaction should fall apart. If you're going to tell me that the Rabbanim don't believe in bitul mekach, below, is that really true? Vatnan. I'm a Mishnah in Baba Metzia. In the Mishnayot that deal with Onah, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Amucher Sefer Torah, Behema Margalit, people who sell a Sefer Torah, animals, and precious jewels, these are items that you could see having values that are very subjective or beyond their market prices. Ein lehem Onah. According to Rabbi Yehuda, no Onah. Amru lo, the Chachamim respond to him, lo amru ela et elu. Only these items that were mentioned in the Mishnah are not subject to Onah, which is Karka, Shtar, and Avadim. Those are the three things mentioned in the Mishnah. Those are the only things that do not have Onah. Otherwise, there is Onah, and they disagree with Rabbi Yehuda. What do you see from this? You see that they believe that there is Bitul Mekach. Because here they're saying, Ein Onah for Shtarot, Karkaot, and Avadim. But everything else has a din of Onah. Onah comes packaged with Bitul Mekach. Now the Rashbam over here has a problem with the Gemara, because you can't prove anything here from the Chachamim's position with regards to Bitul Mekach. The Rashbam says that the way Rabbutai, my Rebbeim, explained it that way, which is, V'chiteima Bitul Mekach the Rabbanan Leitluhu, that the Rabbanan don't hold the Bitul Mekach, rather they hold a course of Ona'ah, because Ona'ah is a Dindo Raito, but their understanding of Ona'ah is simply that you have to return the excess. Never is there a Bitul Mekach, but only the necessity to return the amount that was in excess of the true market price of the item. Velo, is that really true that they don't hold a bitul mekach? That's none. We have a Mishnah that has a machlok between Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim. And the Gemara says, Amrlo, lo amru ela atelu. So from here you see that there is bitul mekach, even according to the Chachamim. The Rishbam does not like this explanation of the Gemara, because you never find any bitul mekach in the sheet of the Chachamim over there. All the Chachamim say to Rabbi Yehuda is that the transaction is not a good transaction in terms of the fact that there is ona'ah. But that means that the Chachamim could also hold, like they do, or supposedly hold over here, that all that means is that the ona'ah is returned, but there's no bitul mekach. You can't prove from that machlok between the Chachamim and Rabbi Yehuda that there is bitul mekach. What you can prove is that they say that there is ona'ah. You want to suggest the Chachamim don't believe in bitul mekach? I'll prove to you they believe in bitul mekach, because in the case of that Mishnah where Rabbi Yehuda suggests there's no ona'ah for these items, they say, no, there is ona'ah for these items. Well, if there's ona'ah for these items, there is bitul mekach. But Rashbam points out that that's not what's being said there. Rabbi Yehuda said that there is no price for Sefer Torah Behemah Margalit. They are items where you could sell them. How much? What does Rabbi Yehuda see is the maximum amount you could differential? Ad kedei de mehem, until their value, which means two times their value, up to two times their value. All you could learn from Rabbi Yehuda's statement and the Chachamim's response is that they believe that there is a different threshold for where ona'ah kicks in. But that threshold only indicates that, not bitul mekach, but that you have to return the money. If you pay too much, you're going to have to give the money back. And so the Rashbam says all the Chachamim are indicating over here is that there is ona'ah in these items. That means that you'd have to return the money. Doesn't mean that there's bitul mekach. Just means you'd have to give the money back. And therefore, the Rashbam says that's all the Gemara is saying over here. But then, just like over here, you're suggesting that when they say there's ona'ah, it means return the money and not bitul mekach. Say the same thing over there. Therefore, the Rashbam says that he thinks the question is a very basic question, which is, do the Chachamim have bitul mekach at all? do they have the concept of ona'ah at all? And the Gemara answers, we can prove to you that they do have a concept of ona'ah, because they argue on Rabbi Yehuda in the Gemara in Baba Metzia. Given that argument, it shows that they do have a din of ona'ah. Once they have a din of ona'ah, that's both for the issue of returning when it equals 1/6 above the market price, as well as bitul mekach when it's in excess of that amount. And even though the Gemara uses the term bitul mekach, the Rishbam says that bitul mekach is used in a more generic sense to mean ona'ah. Doesn't mean literally bitul mekach, but rather means bitul mekach ona'ah, that they don't have ona'ah at all, that they don't hold to this concept of ona'ah, or that they believe that people will overpay in certain circumstances, and therefore ona'ah may not be applicable in situations and circumstances where the item can command a higher value, or there's a certain amount of subjectivity to the item. And then the Gemara's answer is, I can prove to you that's not the case. Because even in items like Sefer Torah, Be'emar, Margalit, which have very subjective values, the Chachamim disagree with Rabbi Yehuda. So certainly over here, by Tzemen and Bakar, they would say that it's not a subjective value, that there is a din of ona'ah. And that explanation obviously would fit much better into the girsa of the Ramban and the Rabbeinu Chananel, who have a girsa here, instead of V'chitema betom pechach the Rabban Ledohu, their girsa was V'chitema ona'ah the Rabbanon Ledohu. So their girsa of ona'ah would then be supportive of this view of the Rashbam. And the explanation we just gave would be even stronger, which is that, is there no ona'ah in certain types of objects? Meaning that ona'ah does apply, obviously, midoraita, but certain objects are outside the framework of ona'ah because they're so subjective in their value, or people need them so badly that they're willing to pay up for them, and then there would be no ona'ah. And again, the proof is, we see from the Mishnah where the Achamim argue on Rabbi Yehuda that that's not the case, that even in objects like Sefer Torah, Behema, and Margalit, they still believe that there's a din of ona'ah, and similarly over here, there's going to be a din of ona'ah by Tzemet and Bakar. And then, Gemara says, Am I in the Mimraya Nami Diktoni? Davi Bitul Mekach. That's what they mean. In the Mishnah, when it said that, they said, money is no proof. They meant not that money is no proof, and therefore the transaction stands. Money is no proof, and according to the way that the Rebbeim, my brother Ashbam, learned, there's Bitul Mekach here. The whole transaction falls apart. Or, according to the Rishbam, just like there's ona'ah by those things, there's ona'ah over here, and it'll be subject to the same rules of ona'ah. At a 60, you refund the money, and above a 60, we'll do bitul mekach. Or, v'ibay teima, some say this, ki amor rabbanan ona'ah bitul mekach, b'chdei shadat toeh. The only time that we say that ona'ah bitul mekach applies is where someone has a view about the price. And you can make a mistake about your view about the price. Because somebody says five, the other one says six, seven. So the real price is five. That's the market price. This guy thought six. That's a reasonable mistake to make. And that person can sue for ona'ah because he says, I was deceived. I was tricked. I paid too much for it. But when somebody pays double the market price for something, then it's seen as being obvious that there's ona'ah over here, or he's knowledgeable about the fact that he's overpaying. Given that, aval b'kdei she'en adat toeh, lo, imur matana yaivle. It must be that he's gifting him the excess money, because nobody would pay that excessive amount. Elim Kane, they were giving the gift of money because they know that this isn't the real price for the item. People make mistakes when they are within a certain range of a normal market price. To pay double the market price or way in excess of the market price, that's something where we would say, this guy knows about it, and now that he knows about it, he gifted the money. So in our case in the Mishnah, when the Chachamim say, oh, he paid 200 zuz for a yoke, that's ridiculous that you'd only pay that for a yoke with Bakar, they say, no, he knows that. And therefore, when he bought the yoke, he clearly knew he was paying way over the amount, and that means that he gifted him the remaining amount. It does what distinguishes this from the case in Kiddushin, where Rav says, Omer Rivam, the leka la mifrach mihocha the Rav damar. From here you can't ask on Rav, Gabe mikadesh ochoto, Adam yodea shein kiddushin tofsim bachoto, v'gamar minatan l'shem pikadon. When you have a transaction where you're giving money, it's considered a pikadon and not a matana. So why over here is it not considered to be a pikadon? So he differentiates between a case where the transaction is kayam, like in our case over here, doesn't make sense that the transaction will stand, and then he'll have to refund the remainder of the money as a pikadon. No, the assumption is if he gave the money and it stays for the tzemed, it also stays as a matana. If For the case of Achoto, where the whole transaction falls apart, because he can't have Kiddushin with his sister, then for sure the granting of the money is a pikadon over there, and not a matana, because none of it sticks, none of the transaction stays in place. So now the Rashbam concludes over here, Umistavra keteirutz acharon. He says the latter answer makes more sense. Bekama shnuya dechikai. The earlier answer to say, well, that's what the Chachamim meant when they say in damim raya, that the Chachamim mean really pitol mekach. He says that's a difficult way to read it. And therefore, he favors the second answer over here. In other words, the Rashbam says the psak halacha is that there's no ona'ah when you go out of a normal range, when you go out of a range that's considered to be a mistake, and rather it's only people who do this consciously would give such amount of money, then there's no ona'ah. All right, we're going to stop here by the Mishnah on the top of Ayin Chet Amud Aleph.